and you shall live. And so with these seemingly simple words, he affirms that loving God with the whole of your being and loving your neighbor as yourself is enough. It's kind of like the Nike Athletic Company's thing. Just do it. And also implied is the understanding that to not do this is in some way to die, both temporally and eternally. So there are consequences involved in not getting it right. So in the parable, I don't know if the young lawyer was working on his debating points or if he was testing Jesus or actually trying to learn something when he asked, "Who is my neighbor?" That question opens a whole new set of doors in a process of revealing what the this is that he has to do in order to live. And in the fashion of a parable, it seems that we have a number of doors either with prizes or surprises behind them waiting to be revealed. So for those who originally heard the parables and for us in our hearing today, what are those surprises? Behind door number one, we have a traveler on the road to Jericho being attacked, beaten, and robbed. This wouldn't have been a particular surprise for those hearing the story. They knew that the road to Jericho was a dangerous stretch. There were bands of robbers, probably known as zealots, who hid out in those hills and used such thievery to finance their revolt against the occupying Roman forces. Anyone who would travel this road alone could reasonably expect to be attacked. It might be as similar to driving out on Highway 34 between the river and the freeway. It's a dangerous stretch of highway with an inordinate number of traffic accidents. Or, tragically, in light of the events of this past week, it might be like a young black African-American male driving while black, subjected to an inordinate number of traffic stops by police, some of which can and do end tragically. The story continues with the man once again alone, half dead alongside the road. And behind door number two, we have a surprise in that the priest and the Levite, the moral and spiritual leaders of their community, did not stop to provide compassionate assistance. Maybe they didn't stop because to have contact with such a bleeding man would make them ritually unclean and therefore unable to perform their religious duties for a period of time. And it happens in our communities that religious leaders can get caught up in certain aspects or details of their ministry responsibilities, such that we seem blind to or unresponsive to other needs that cry out for our response in the community. Behind door number three, we do have a surprise, maybe a rather unpleasant one, because along comes a Samaritan who has compassion, cares for the traveler's wounds, puts him on his beast and transports him to the nearest inn and provides for his continuing care. This was an unpleasant surprise for the members of Jesus' Jewish audience in that for them, the Samaritans represented a group of half-breed heretics whose ancestors had not only intermarried with the wrong occupying armies, but they also worshiped God at the wrong shrine on the wrong mountaintop. In short, they redeemed a reprehensible lot, and no good Jew would even live in the same valley with them, let alone consider them a man laying alongside the road. Adding to this antipathy was the fact that this was essentially a family feud, in that the Samaritans shared a common faith heritage and history with the Jews. And we all know how family feuds can be some of the most difficult ones for us to navigate or at least tolerate. And through reading the Gospels, we see that Jesus, of course, used the Samaritans often in trying to help his Jewish followers understand his own teachings more fully. Like the fact that the neighbor you're called to love is not only that friendly, compatible person next door, the one who thinks, looks, believes, and acts like you do. Your neighbor is also the person or persons that you are least likely to identify in that way. The person who is seemingly different from you, who is other, who is stranger, or who is even enemy to you. The person who's the wrong gender, the wrong race, the wrong sexual orientation, the wrong nationality, the wrong religion, even the wrong political affiliation, or a supporter of the wrong athletic team. In and of itself, a story of compassion shared in this way would not have been a big surprise, except for the messiness of that Samaritan character. The irony would be that within our own Christian heritage, we have clearly bought into or kind of aligned ourselves with the importance of sharing compassion in the practice of our faith. Why, we've even named countless churches, Church of the Good Samaritan up the road, hospitals, Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center, schools, counseling centers, why, even travel trailer clubs in honor of this Good Samaritan. And we've done this without even swallowing hard, let alone choking on such a notion of a Good Samaritan as Jesus' original followers probably did. The Dalai Lama has determined that compassion for the other is at the root of the teachings of all of the world's abiding faith traditions. But in this parable, Jesus seems to be echoing a more radical and unique teaching that we hear it in a portion of Matthew's gospel, what we call the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says that not only shall we love our neighbor, the one who is like us, but we shall also love the one we identify as enemy. So, with these three doors and the characters behind them revealed, Jesus seems to kind of wrap up the story and its message by turning back to the young lawyer and asking, which of these three do you think was neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? But rather than closing that story, this question opens a whole new door, one that we hadn't even anticipated. Remember earlier when I invited you in the reading of the gospel to pay particular attention to how that parable is framed? If you remember, it's framed by questions, both at the front end and at the back end. My own understanding of the significance of these questions came through the help of Lane McGahey. Lane is a United Methodist clergy colleague and a scholar of New Testament Greek language. Lane was one of the co-founders of the Jesus Seminar, which is for him either a point of fame or infamy, depending on your perspective on their work. But earlier in my ministry career, I was director of the Subtle Lake United Methodist Camp, which is up in the Cascade Range east of here. And in that role, I worked with Lane to write a summer camp curriculum on the parables of Jesus. And as we were working on unpacking this particular parable, Lane let me know that in the original Greek language, in the structure of that language, this parable holds a significant twist or surprise. So let's say we've opened door number four, and behind door number four, we have the question of which actor in this parable are we invited, even challenged, to identify ourselves with in the parable? In a sense, who was this young lawyer being asked to identify with? By tradition, again, ironically, we seem to have been taught to identify with the Samaritan who offered compassionate aid, and we've responded appropriately in that mode, as Jesus seemed to tell us or to teach us when he said, go and do likewise. But remember that the lawyer's question, who is my neighbor? And it's framed on the back end by Jesus' question, which of these three was neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? As a parable about God's grace, Lane, my friend, contends that we are asked to identify with the man in the ditch. Not the one who lends aid, but the one who receives it. Not the one who extends God's gift of grace, but the one who receives it. Because this is the way that it happens all too often. We like to think that we are in command and control of our own lives, that we are self-sufficient to make our own plans, to achieve our goals, that we don't need any help. This might be reflected in our greater willingness to be helpers, to show strength in extending aid to others, than we are willing to acknowledge our own need for help, to betray what might be perceived as a weakness, to serve rather than to be served. Sometimes our resistance to asking for help, for receiving help, is so great that we end up like that man in the ditch, beaten and bloodied, unable to help ourselves, and unable to resist the help, the grace that is extended by others and through others by God. And to the sharp twist, the radical point of this parable is that we are called to a place of vulnerability wherein we are challenged to allow ourselves to be loved, even or especially by those we identify as our enemy, and to trust that such grace, such love, will be life transforming. So this has been a challenging week for us in the life of our community here, our communities around the nation. And through the tragic events of this past week, you all know the math. 2 more black men shot and killed by police officers in Baton Rouge and Minneapolis. And then 5 police officers killed by a sniper in Dallas. And it seems clear that these communities, indeed our nation, together we find ourselves caught in places of fear and profound vulnerability. And that sense that we are clearly in need of help, that we need guidance to work our way through this and to find a new path. In what I say now, I want to be careful to say that I'm not saying any of this in a way of meaning to vilify or denigrate anyone or any community. But among others, the events of this past week reflect at least 2 kinds of fear and or vulnerability. 1 is among various police officers, though clearly not all police officers, who seem to be afraid of black African American men, afraid of some physical or emotional power that these men seem to hold. And this is a fear or mistrust that leads them, these police officers, to resort all too often to the use of their guns in subduing a black suspect. The second would be the fear that young black men have of being stopped, pulled over, even arrested by police officers, because all too often they can end up dead because the taillight on their car was out. And each of these end up seeing the other as the enemy. And all of us struggle with the question of what we can do to end these cycles of fear and violence. And so as I stand here as a white, educated, heterosexual male, a picture of all the privilege that we find in North America, I struggle to put myself in the shoes, particularly of these young black men, students that I speak with on campus who live with this fear daily. And so, just in a personal note, I want to say I was disturbed yesterday morning as I heard on the news from a law enforcement official in Dallas who stated that they had given this young man, identified as the sniper, two options as they negotiated with him over a period of time. He could lay down his arms and surrender himself to their custody, or they would kill him. So I invite you to imagine with me what kind of choice this represents for this obviously disturbed young black man, filled with fear, with anger, with rage. Put yourself in his shoes if you can. He was committing his act of violence, and it was an incredible act of violence, in response to the fact that these other two black men had died as a result of their encounters with police in their communities, as well as others before them. In his state of mind, why should he expect that surrendering himself to the Dallas police would result in anything other than his death? For him, his only choice was about which way he would die. By his choice of not surrendering him, the police made the choice for him as they sent in a robot with plastic explosives to blow him up. Our nation is caught up with too many varied expressions of fear and violence in our life together. We know this all too well as we are in the midst of presidential primaries and eventually presidential electoral campaigns. Jesus modeled for us a way of nonviolence, and he taught us that violence will not solve violence. We do not repay evil with evil. He said, "Be not afraid." That doesn't mean that we don't have fear, but we do not choose to live, to abide, to dwell in that place of fear, that we find a way beyond that fear. Rather than being that warrior, king, savior like King David, he taught us to love the other and to allow ourselves to be loved. He taught us to practice vulnerability, a vulnerability that was paradoxically also a way of practicing strength. He said this, "Do this and you will live." So how then shall we live? Where will we find hope? How shall we experience healing? Whom will we ask for help? Amen.